You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This episode is packed full of great upcoming book events in Brighton and Sussex, as well as some great local authors and publishers. We will also discuss this summer's hottest rom-com, Honey and Spice by Bolu Babalola. We speak to William Shaw about Fatal Shaw, which is part of the Shaw and Word Festival. Lots of Shaws in there. We talk to Leslie Wood about The Coast is Queer, Susanna Stevenson about Charleston Small Wonder Festival. Mark Thompson joins Caitlin to talk about his new book, Eternal City, out with Sussex-based Red Dog Press. And I talk to writer Helen Trevorrow about her new book called New Brighton, followed by a discussion about this month's book, Honey and Spice, with the book's editor, Katie Packer. This episode of the Brighton Book Club is sponsored by Balance Kids, and I am joined by the founder, Ollie, to talk more about that. Ollie, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You do all kinds of yoga in and around Brighton. Give us the list.
Yes, so we teach yoga to, I suppose, anyone that will listen. We go teach from babies, mum and baby, nursery age children, primary school, teenagers, family yoga, parties, the lot, everyone.
So there's something that you do that I'm so interested in, is that you use often like books and creativity in your yoga for young people. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Oh, well, children love books. And I think the best way to make yoga accessible and meaningful to them is to use stories. Children's books really lend themselves to yoga. A lot of postures in yoga are animals and things in nature, as are storybooks, The Gruffalo, for example, all those kinds of things. So we'll run through the stories and we'll act out the poses, and they absolutely love it.
So I don't have children myself, but I know many young people who I cannot imagine being still. Is Balance Kids about being still?
Absolutely not. We are all about meeting children at their energy level and then giving them the skills and the tools, whether that's through story, singing, play, sensory, to then learn how to self-regulate, calm down, but also if they need to shake it out and run it out, knowing that that's an option too.
Ollie, thank you so much for sponsoring this episode of the Brighton Book Club. How can anyone listening find and follow you guys and see the wonderful list of yoga classes that you have on offer?
Well, you can head to my website, balancekids.co.uk, or you can find me on Instagram as balancekids_yoga, and also on YouTube if you want to do it at home.
Up next, I'm welcoming to the show Leslie Wood. Leslie is the Chief Executive of New Writing South. Leslie joins us today to talk about The Coast is Queer, Brighton and Hove's LGBTQ+ Literature Festival, and the amazing things we can expect from the festival programme. The festival will be running from the 7th to the 9th of October this year. Welcome to the show, Leslie.
Thank you for having me.
For those who may not know, what is The Coast is Queer all about?
So, The Coast is Queer is an LGBTQ+ literature festival. This is the third edition that we've run of the festival. The first one we held in 2019 in the Spire. The second one was online, needless to say, in 2021. And now we're at the Attenborough Centre for the Creative Arts at Sussex University. And got just a fantastic lineup of writers, playwrights, poets, podcasters, you name it, we've got it.
And so who and what can we expect to see at this year's festival?
On Friday evening, we have Juno Dawson interviewing in conversation with Travis Alabanza, which I think will be a fantastic fantastic event. Travis has a new book out, None of the Above, and Juno's new book went straight to, it's called Her Majesty's Royal Coven, and it's a book for adults, which is a bit of a change for Juno, and that went straight to be a bestseller for the Sunday Times. We have Sarah Winman, whose book Still Life is a wonderful book featuring that an incredible thing, and an older lesbian who's not mad, bad or dead. So she's not the main character, I have to say, but just the mere fact that she's there is enough to is enough to get us excitable. She's in conversation with Beatrice Hitchman, who is a local author, and her new book, All of You, Every Single One, was longlisted for the Polari Prize this year. So that will be a really interesting interview. We've also got Neil Bartlett, talking to Okachukwu Nzelu. So Neil Bartlett's new book. It's the first time Neil's written a full-length novel since 2014, so that's a really exciting thing, and it'll be really interesting to hear what he's got to say. And Okachukwu is a relatively new novelist. He's just had his second book out here again now. And so I think he's based in Manchester, and he's a very interesting new novelist. So I'm looking forward, I think, to hearing the sort of more experienced and the newer writers coming together. Oh, look, it goes on and on. We've got the Bad Gays from the Bad Gays podcast talking to us. We've got Elias Jashan, who's the editor of This Arab is Queer. We've got Teja Sin, Keeping the House author. Michael Cashman is also on the Sunday, the 9th. And a lot of younger people might not know who Michael is, but he's an incredibly important LGBT activist. He's been an MEP, he's a Labour peer, he's one of the founders of Stonewall. He's written a book called One of Them, from Albert Square to Parliament Square, because back in the day he was in EastEnders, and he was actually the person who did the first ever gay kiss on television, I think in something like 1987. Very and cool. Honestly, it was such a big deal. It was such a big deal to have a gay kiss. It's hard to believe now, but it was such a big deal then. And so it goes on. Julia Armfield, who wrote the wonderful Our Wives Under the Sea. Yeah. We've got poets Fran Locke, John McCulloch. We've got John Ransom, Leonie Ross, Claire Summerskill. It goes on and on and on.
I mean, it sounds like an absolutely fantastic lineup. There are some authors that have written some fantastic books and ones that I really want to read in that lineup. So it sounds amazing. For those who want to attend the festival, and I would encourage everyone to go along, where is it? So it's being held at the Attenborough Centre. Where can we buy tickets and when are they available?
The tickets are going on sale on the 2nd. And you can buy them from the Attenborough Centre's website. You could also have a look at the Coast is Queer website. It's just coastisqueer.com. And that will have all of the information about who's on, when they're on, who's talking to whom, etc. I would encourage everybody to come. We're also running films, the BFI in particular, and some independent filmmakers are providing short films for us. So we're going to have them running all weekend. So there'll be things going on for the whole time that mean that people can come in the morning and stay for the whole day. We've got DJ Ritu from Club Kali doing a session on the Saturday night. So it's all happening at the Coast is Queer. But I'd really like to encourage people to take public transport out there, particularly on the Saturday, because there is a home game at the Amex that day.
Yeah.
So give yourselves plenty of time to get out there, to travel out there. But there are good buses and good trains out there. So do try and get public transport.
Excellent. And for those keen cyclists, I'm sure they can cycle out there as well.
Yeah, of course.
Brilliant. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a fantastic festival. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Leslie.
Well, thank you very much for having us, and I look forward to seeing you and everybody.
Next up, I'm chatting with William Shaw, author of best-selling detective novels and now curator of Fatal Shaw, a new all-day festival coming to Shoreham this October. Fatal Shaw is the work of William and fellow local crime author Ellie Griffiths and forms part of the annual Shoreham Wordfest Literary Festival. Welcome to the show, William.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us all about Fatal Shaw. Why did you decide to curate a crime writing element for Shoreham Wordfest?
Me and Ellie did an event last year at Shoreham Wordfest, and I think it was partly just because, A, it's a great festival with a really lovely audience who come to a lot of stuff, which is always a bit of a blessing. But, you know, I think also we impressed them a bit by bringing some new people to their audience, because the really interesting thing is the crime audience has really sort of, it's crime readers and writers have kind of almost formed a community together.
Yeah.
And I think it's really lovely to see that sort of community grow. And when you go to a festival, people turn out and a lot of people know each other already, so you've got this really sort of friendly sort of atmosphere. So I think it was good to see that and good to be able to demonstrate that to Shoreham Wordfest. Well, hopefully we will. This is our first attempt at it, but we both love Ellie Griffiths and I love going to crime festivals because of that atmosphere, because you get to meet these readers. So we thought we'd have a go ourselves.
Brilliant. And so what can we expect on the day? Who will we see? What sort of things will there be for people attending to do?
Well, it's we're basically taking the panel structure where we put sort of crime writers and people who are interested in crime together to give various talks together and then to open it up with the audience. We've got some really brilliant ones, like our big star panel is like Kate Moss, Ruth Met Ware, Dreda Say Mitchell and Ellie talking about their new book of Marple stories that they've all collaborated on for the Agatha Christie estate. We've got lots of new writers who have sort of burst onto the scene in the last couple of years, like Nadine Matheson, and then old hands like Simon Toyne, who's a local writer, who's a great writer. We've got some really excellent new talent. There's a writer called Eamon Olongay, who's a Nigerian-British writer, who I just think superb thriller writer. Trevor Wood from the Northeast, he writes these wonderful thrillers that are set amongst the homeless community up in Newcastle. Lots of writers. I mean, there's 19 of us, and I always, whenever I come on this podcast, I always forget all the names of everybody we're doing. But and then in the evening, Shoreham Ward First is also programming Simon Brett and Lynn Truss. So you kind of get this sort of bookends at the end of the evening, which is you know, a more sort of lighthearted approach. You know, writers like Nadine Matheson, you know, Dorothy Coombson may have the sort of grimmer end of crime, but there's also a kind of the funny end of it at the end of the evening.
Absolutely. And will people attending be able to get their books signed? Will you have a bookstall?
Yeah, we're working with City Books, actually. They're going to have lots of writers there. And that's one of the great things, I think, if you come along to a crime festival, you can just sort of rock up and find yourself standing in the queue for the tea next to a writer you really admire and can have a conversation with them, but then get them to sign your books. And that's obviously, you know, writers actually, weirdly enough, love signing their books. You know, that it means that they've sort of made a connection in that kind of way. So yeah, it's very much supposed to be open that way. And we've got little sessions where, which are less formal, just so we can all sort of meet in the same room and have a little bit of a chat about where things are and kind of work out whether this is a good thing to do and whether we want to do it again next year and whether audiences want to come. I mean, the nice thing that was where we're already selling tickets from well outside of our area, which amazing. I think crime fiction also does. You know, we've got lots of people coming down from London just because they're excited to be part of something with that kind of lineup.
Absolutely. I think you've got Theakston up in the north, so to have a crime festival in the south for people who live in this area is just a fantastic opportunity.
I totally agree. And the nice thing about Shoreham is that, you know, we all know the area because this is where we live. But actually, if you're coming from out, it's a lovely little place to visit. And there are B&Bs around there that are affordable. So that, you know, ideally, you know, you go to Harrogate, it's quite expensive to stay there, but you know, you can have quite a nice reasonable weekend in a beautiful little seaside town, a really interesting little seaside town, and see a few people murdered or hear about it anyway.
Definitely. And so the Shoreham Wordfest is running in October, and the Fatal Shore runs on Saturday the 15th of October from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. at the Shoreham Centre. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about the programme?
Well, you can buy tickets for individual panels for £10, but it's £40 for a day ticket. So, you know, you can't really go wrong in that kind of programme. And we think it's a really good value day. There's a few now of these festivals beginning to emerge, which have quite a nice low cost entry point, because the point is just to get all sorts of readers there. And that's one of the things that I think crime does. I'm just looking through my list of readers. Vaseem Khan. Brilliant writer, new book actually out this week, The Lost Man of Bombay. He writes such a good series set in Bombay in the post-partition sort of era. Brilliant writer, really worth catching up with him. Really hotly tipped. Leslie Thompson, local Lewis author, brilliant writer too. Githa Lodge, who writes a really great detective series sort of set in the 80s and gradually moving into the present. I did mention Dorothy Coombson again, the very famous Dorothy Coombson. Mm-hmm. We've also got Greg Moss coming along. He's a debut writer. And that's one of the things we're doing panels, because a lot of the people who are readers are also would-be writers. We want to have a lot of that sort of sense of access. So we're doing some things with debut writers and also about some of the routes to getting your crime fiction published. There's a writer called P.D. Viner who's been through the ringer and approached writing from many angles, and he's really good on talking about routes in and how to sort of keep your morale up when you're struggling with agents. We're going to get an agent down, Julia Crouch, another writer, very experienced in that sort of stuff. So lots and lots of great names and people who are, I think, really engaging.
Yeah, brilliant. It sounds like it's going to be a really well-rounded experience for everyone who attends. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show, William, and I hope you have a fantastic turnout. Thank you.
Thank you. That's absolutely brilliant.
Small Wonder Festival is back at Charleston and runs from the 13th to the 16th of October 2022. I am joined now by Susanna Stevenson, the Artistic Director of Literature Programmes at Charleston, to tell us more. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
What is Charleston?
So Charleston is a fantastic historical house nestled in the foot of the South Downs, not far outside Lewes. And it's an amazing house decorated by members of the Bloomsbury set, but especially Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant, who lived there for many years. So every surface is painted and it contains fantastic furniture and objects and has an amazing garden. And that's just what we do at the heart of it. So everything we do is inspired by the house and by the people who lived and worked there. So people like Virginia Woolf, E.M. Forster, of course, Vanessa Bell, Duncan Grant, John Maynard Keynes. It really was a hub of ideas and art and thinking about the world differently. And we're keeping that spirit alive with our programme of public events and festivals like Small Wonder.
Small Wonder celebrates the smaller form, the shorter things in literature. Why is that important?
Well, I think when people think about literature and books, they're so often thinking about, you know, novels and big tomes and lengthy works. But actually, if you think about how we're communicating day to day and a lot of the work that people perhaps write even without thinking about it, we're talking about letters, diaries, essays, articles. But also when you start thinking about the short form, you're also talking about jokes, lyrics, recipes. All of these are ways of using language to capture our lives and communicate with each other. And so, of course, there are things that Virginia Woolf's essays are very famous. But you can look at the contemporary life and find out so much by looking at this lens of the short form. And of course, short stories was always at the heart of Small Wonder. And it was the first ever short story festival in the UK. So we're continuing that legacy of looking at the short form and it's amazing, almost like, imagine it as the distilled gin bottle of literary expression. You know, you've boiled it down to the good stuff, which is at the core of so much concise work.
Amazing. So who's going to be there? What are the highlights for you this year?
Well, obviously I can't choose because it's all brilliant and people should go on the Charleston website and have a look at the full Small Wonder programme because it's 4 days, 20 events and lots of different things. But since I have to pull out a few, I think one unexpected one, perhaps Claudia Roden, the amazing cookery book writer, will be speaking about recipes. We've got Jim Moyer talking about, you know, comedic expression. And he's more often known as Vic Reeves. We've also got some new short stories inspired by Miss Marple, discussions about biography, about writing, and amazing authors like, you know, Neil Bartlett and Natasha Brown, Will Self, Irena Sinokaji, all coming to Charleston to speak. I also wanted to mention, though, we've got a family show as part of Small Wonder as well for the first time. So, you know, children's books, another fantastic example of low word count, but incredible impact. And so the I Want My Hat Back trilogy will be at Charleston, two shows each of the mornings over the weekend of the 15th and 16th of October. So for anyone who saw the amazing digital cardboard viral shows throughout lockdown made by Ian Nicholson and Sam Wilde, we've got the live version in the hay barns starting off the weekend days as well. So there really is a lot of things. If you want to come and do a writing workshop with Arvon or bring the family to the show, there's so much to explore.
How can we book our ticket, Susanna, but also how can we get there?
So to book your ticket, just go to the Charleston website. If you search Charleston, you know, Small Wonder, you will find it. And in terms of getting to us, you know, you can make your own way here. There are cycle lanes all the way up to Charleston now from Eastbourne. And we are also making life really easy for people by running a minibus shuttle service from Lewes Station and Charleston all the way through the festival. And it, the good thing is if you arrive by the bus, which is free, you also qualify for a Green Traveller concession ticket. So we're trying to make it as easy and as green as possible for people to come and enjoy the festival over the weekend.
It sounds absolutely wonderful and I'm very much looking forward to it. Thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you.
Today I'm joined by author Mark Thompson. Mark, his first book, Dust, has been translated into both German and Chinese, is about to release his second novel, Eternal City, with Red Door Press. Eternal City is out on the 8th of September and follows the story of 20-something photographer Finn. So delighted to have you here today, Mark.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
So can you tell us a bit about your new book, Eternal City?
Yeah, it was inspired really by sort of going back a little bit in time. My father, who was a wonderful man, died unexpectedly, and he'd said to me, I've traveled a lot, and he'd said to me, have you still not been to Rome? And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, if you haven't been to Rome, you haven't lived. So when he died, I felt really compelled to go to Rome. Mm. So I did, and I went over. It was winter time when I went, but the weather was great. And I went to visit Keats House Museum, which is next to the Spanish Steps. And I had no real agenda when I went, just to spend time there. And the lady who ran the museum mentioned that he was buried in the non-Catholic cemetery, which is also called the English cemetery. And she said it's a beautiful place and it's worth a visit if you have time. So anyway, I decided to visit the non-Catholic cemetery and went up there, and it was the most beautiful kind of garden. It was just a beautiful place to be. And next to it is the tomb of Caius Cestius, who was a Roman senator. And it's just this great big pyramid. I don't know, it's probably about 50 feet high or something next to the cemetery. And it's a really dynamic thing, and obviously a great piece of Roman history there. So I discovered as I walked around that Shelley was buried there as well. Right. And the more I looked, the more fascinating I found it, and the more fascinating people who seemed to be there. So I just thought, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if all of these fascinating people were able to, give their view on the modern world and things that they've seen through history. And that was really my inspiration to write it.
I mean, yeah, it sounds fascinating. I had no idea that there were so many well-known people like buried in that area as well. This is not a spoiler. It's on the blurb of the book, but your main character, Finn, has died at the beginning of the book. What made you want to start the book that way?
Well, I really needed a mechanism to get a narrator, my central kind of character and narrator, across the divide from, the living world to a world beyond. So in order to do that, I just sort of contrived for him to have an accident and find himself then in the company of all these amazing people.
And in the afterlife, Finn is surrounded by many long dead notable names of poets and artists like John Keats. Did you decide to write them in because they were in the cemetery, or where did you draw them in from?
I just thought the idea of having Shelley and Keats, back to life, as it were, viewing the modern world, was kind of fascinating in itself. And I also wanted to kind of really sort of test my own agnosticism, really. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool agnostic, I suppose, really. I think if I can't prove something, then I can't prove it. But if I can't disprove it, I can't dismiss it either.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
Yeah, and I found that the idea of the non-Catholic cemetery was that the people who were buried there were either, Protestant, Jewish, Greek Orthodox, whatever they were in terms of religion at that time, or atheist. And for some reason, they weren't deemed worthy to be buried with the Catholics, which is why, you know, the non-Catholic cemetery came about. And I thought that there's an interesting facet within that, that the idea of it's a kind of discrimination, you know, that you can't be buried, or, you know, a person couldn't be buried with the Catholics because they just simply weren't good enough to be buried with the Catholics. So I thought that was an interesting kind of thought, which is very current, really. And, you know, there's so much division in the world, and, you know, between religions and, you know, basically atheists, people have no belief in God, or, you know, and a lot of people have spiritual belief that there is something, but they don't know whether it's God or whatever, and they don't ascribe to organized religion. So I thought it was quite interesting to have these sort of different viewpoints from, you know, the Romantics were, you know, Shelley and Keats were very much of the idea that imagination was what really drove us and basically filled our world. Whereas obviously, you know, devout religious people believe that God, you know, has created the world and God oversees the world, and agnostics like me have no idea. So it just seemed there were so many opportunities to bring some of the people to life. Some of the characters I kind of created to suit, you know, the narrative that I wanted to pursue through it. And Gramsci, he was the Italian, the founder of the Italian Communist Party and a dyed-in-the-wool atheist, but a very interesting character when I researched him. So I thought, you know, having a combination of genuine people who were there and, you know, a few additional characters that, you know, I invented to suit the flow of the story. It's a good mix.
Absolutely. And I mean, you've mentioned it there, but there's so many points of philosophical thought, you know, touches on religion, at how we feel about things, how we perceive our place in the world. What sort of thoughts and emotions do you hope that Eternal City will leave your readers with?
I'm really hoping that there'd be some sense, possibly for the reader, that there may be something after this life, you know, that some sort of comfort in the idea as well that, you know, people we've lost, you know, family and friends and, you know, parents and so on, that there may be something beyond just eternal quiet or dark, or, you know, just
something a bit more colourful.
Life beyond.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. And I don't suppose anybody really knows. Well, certainly I don't. But just the speculation of that, I think, could be quite a comforting thing for people reading the book. I mean, there are, you know, sort of darker elements to it, and there are, you know, some sadder parts in it and some lighter parts. But yeah, I think ultimately it's about thinking not just about life and death, but also about things that we regard as normal now in our kind of society. And I've taken a little bit of a swipe at what I think is the vacuousness of our kind of celebrity obsession with celebrity culture and and social media and, you know, various elements of modern life that I wondered how people like Shelley and Keats would regard them, you know, because they weren't terribly famous in their own day. I mean, Keats certainly wasn't.
No.
But now, you know, they're household names, and pretty much they're on the library shelves of every library probably on earth. And how they would view celebrity status that now is ascribed to them, you know, just by their universal acceptance as great poets and, you know, and great thinkers, how they would react to how we as a society now view success and celebrity, and how we measure that.
Yeah,
Absolutely. And I guess it's that, for me, I certainly, when reading it, you wonder how they see, you know, their entire job as writers and artists was to be earnest and authentic in their time, and how they would see the kind of the lack of authenticity in a lot of facets of modern life is a really interesting question. As we mentioned, Eternal City is coming out on the 8th of September. It's a wonderful book, and I'm sure everyone listening would enjoy reading it. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Caitlin. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I am joined by local author Helen Trevorrow, whose new book called New Brighton is out now with Red Dog Press. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Helen.
Thank you so much for having me, Anna. It's a privilege to be on here, so thanks so much.
Can you tell us about this very intriguing book?
So New Brighton is a thriller, foremost. It's a speculative thriller, and it's set in Brighton, and it's very difficult to talk too much about it without giving away some of the major plot points. But I think it's pretty safe to say that people realise it's kind of set in the slightly near future. And everything looks familiar. But as we meet the main character, Robin Lockhart, she's being coerced, and she doesn't really realise everything that's happening to her. And she starts to find things out about Brighton, which is slightly weird to her. And it sets off this whole journey. And one of the things that happens to her, which is in the start of the book, is that a very strange, enigmatic ship is washed up on the shore of Brighton. And I use the Athena B, which was washed up in 1980, as a kind of inspiration for that. And on the ship, there's something very strange and weird. And that kickstarts a huge journey for the main character, Robin Lockhart. And she starts off as a very kind of weak, easily led, manipulated kind of person to someone who's very strong.
Absolutely wonderful. Why did you decide to set it in Brighton, Helen, apart from the obvious that you live here?
Well, I haven't always lived here. I lived in London before, like many of people who sort of travel down from London. So I wanted to write something that really celebrated kind of like the brand values, if you like, of Brighton, what it's like to live here. And that's really sort of open-minded, slightly, you know, cookie kind of setup that we've got going on, which is so fantastic, why everyone loves living here. So it's really, the book's really diverse. There are trans characters, gay characters. There's kind of that bit of weirdness that we all love about Brighton. That's definitely in the book. And there's a kind of subplot as well about someone else in the book. He really loves Brighton, one of the main characters. And so he has chosen to kind of glorify Brighton in a certain way. So the setting is the setting, and it's Brighton, but it's actually a little bit more than that. And I've tried to make Brighton a bit of a character in its own right. So yeah, it's a little bit more than just the place setting. It gives a bit more, and it's really crucial to the plot as well.
So you've talked a bit about the brand values of Brighton, but I'd really like to know about any research you did in the kind of underbelly of Brighton when you were writing this book.
Well, I mean, I did loads of research, actually. And, you know, some of it, if you go out in Brighton, you can kind of see the surface of what's going on. But I really wanted to see the sort of dark underbelly. And you can go for a night out and kind of discover lots of things about that. And one of the things that really made me sort of think was that Brighton University's actually got one of the world's first quantum computers. And that it's quite jarring in a way. You've got this great fun sort of holiday town that we all love eating and drinking and being creative and going out, and then it's kind of propped up by, we've got this amazing bit of science and technology which is happening in our backyard that we don't know about. So I've kind of fused the two together in a kind of technological weirdness and story. So I really fuse those, because Brighton's got a lot, you know, we love to go down the front and have beers and listen to music and dance, but there's so much that's actually going on in business and technology. It's really innovative. It really spurs creativity in people. You get people moving down here with boring jobs who change career, or they do two things at once. That's a really kind of new idea. Lots of people are doing this now since COVID, but people have been doing it here for years. You do two things and you're fully both. You fully do one job and you fully do another job. And that's fine. So you can be creative and you can pay the bills or whatever you need to do. So I think that's quite a unique way of thinking, and Brighton really spurs people on to do that.
Absolutely. Can you read us some, Helen, and give us a bit of context about what bit you're reading from?
Sure. So I'm going to read you a little bit, which is the back end of chapter four. And in the lead up to this, we've met our main character, Robin Lockhart, who's gone out to a sort of indie goth club night and had an argument with her very good looking boyfriend, Vincent. Following the argument, she has gone home with the barmaid, Tiffany Schechter, and has left because the two of them were disturbed by this huge noise on the seafront, sort of metal scraping against metal. And it's the next morning and Vincent phones Robin to come down to the seafront. So I'm just going to read a couple of pages, about three pages from there. It's only just light. There's a familiar cushion of protective grey clouds lining the sky. Clearing over the sea, the sky pops in blue. It is pure cold with an unexpected bite. It takes 10 minutes to walk to the seafront. I'm wearing a red woolen jumper beneath a see-through, yes, see-through as in transparent, plastic waterproof coat of Mum's. The smell is rich, clear oxygen, surprisingly underlined by sweet metallic rust. Vincent runs up Little Preston Street to meet me. He's waving and giddy. His hair is flyaway and his shirt is untucked. I've never seen him like this. He takes my hand, kisses it, and makes me run with him. It's pretty cute. That's nice, I say, meaning the hand-holding and general positive demeanour. I want to ask if he's still drunk, but I daren't broach the subject of intoxication. I was wrong to leave you last night, he says, and that suits me because I'm happy to forget all about it. We're running close to Tiffany's flat and I start to prickle with nerves. I don't want her to see me in this coat of Mother's. Look, Vincent shouts. Right there in the middle of the beach, between the two piers, sits a ship. It's as tall as a church steeple and sharp to a point, and has made a solid wave of stones either side of its bow. We weave between the cars, open-mouthed, making our way towards it. Vincent and I grip each other's hands and we get up to the green railings of the seafront. The ship is copper-coloured and dusty with rust. I can taste it in my mouth. It's in the air. We're breathing it in. It sits tilted over to the right, and I can't understand how it didn't collide with the West Pier. People must be able to see it from several streets behind. The tide has tucked back out, leaving the vessel's rotten barnacles exposed. The hull is full of dents, and what paint is left on the starboard side flails off in pieces. A ripped flag in faded red and green has wilted at the stern. This was the noise that disturbed Tiffany and I last night. I look up behind me to where Tiffany's now standing on her balcony, drinking tea from a cup. She watches me and salutes me like a soldier, and I squeeze Vincent's hand and stare at his face to make sure that he hasn't seen her. It's a ship, Robin, a ship right here in the city, says Vincent, breathless. I've never heard him talk so much. The police are already here. They point and shout, pushing people back. They've erected a cordon of blue and white tape. A policeman bangs on the bonnets of cars, getting people to drive away. A TV news van has arrived and cameras pan around, recording the sea. The kids have got through, their faces rubbed red with cold. Where the ship's metal bow is embedded in the stones, they write their names on the hull with lumps of white Brighton chalk. Out at sea, a lifeboat balances on top of the waves, impotent. Through a tiny window inside the ship, I see a shadow. I shiver. It's the vague outline of a tall, thin body seen through a slip of glass. Maybe nothing. Large seagulls circle above. Perhaps it was just the shadow of a bird. Sirens start up all over the city and get closer. From east and west, more people arrive. The police are stopping anyone behind us. A man dressed as Elvis Presley stands agog in the middle of the road with a can of beer in his hand. Move it, says a policeman. Where's it from? Asks Vincent. Safety measures in place now, ladies and gentlemen. Back away to the other side of the road, and they start to funnel us back and away from the front. And we quickly become gridlocked, us and the kids and Elvis, and we shuffle back in turn, necks bent, eyes fixed on the ship. a convoy of green army trucks splits the crowds open like an axe. And when they stop, they come alive with soldiers carrying machine guns spilling out from behind the tarpaulin at the rear. "What the fuck is happening?" Vincent says, his mood shifting. My heartbeat picks up. We all start moving away faster, and I notice that the way we're being marshalled is taking us right past Tiffany's building. Is that enough?
That is so amazing and gripping. I kind of forgot where I was for a second there.
Well, it goes on. It gets a little bit more scary, that section. But yeah, it all gets very, weird from there.
So this book has been compared to The Handmaid's Tale and Blade Runner. I'd love to know what works influenced your writing of New Brighton.
Well, yeah. I mean, there were so many... You know, obviously that's a massive accolade that publishers write, and it's nowhere near as wonderful as The Handmaid's Tale, which is one of my favourite books. But I was definitely influenced by that genre. I really love science fiction, and I really love science fiction which has a foot in the now, so you don't really feel, or as you grow, you just kind of. You feel that something's, you know, changing and is weird. So one of the recent books is Naomi Alderman's The Power. I absolutely love that. It's such a clever take on just a very small change, although it's a speculative, quite weird. It just, such a small change has such a dramatic effect on the world. And she does it so well. So, yeah, that would definitely be one of the books that has influenced. And this is a little bit more like, there are some films like... some of the plot twists, you know, it's similar to it's like a Matrix set in Brighton with a girl as the main character is maybe one kind of influence as well, I suppose. So yeah, it becomes quite fast moving, but there's a lot about, someone's even changed their name actually as a result of reading the book. I can't believe it. And someone else is getting a tattoo apparently. So it does work on certain levels of people feeling really connected to it, and especially the bit that the main character Robin Lockhart, she's kind of fed all this information and she doesn't know what's real or not real, and it's her kind of finding out and finding the truth and seeing the world as it is for herself, which is quite powerful, people tell me.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations, Helen. I'm so excited about this book and highly recommend it to anyone, especially people who love Brighton. One question I love to ask writers who are based in a city is, what is it like to be a writer here?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I just love Brighton. And I think for so many reasons, it's so creative and supportive. I think it's probably one of the best places to live in the UK. I'm a lesbian, I'm gay, I'm married, I've got a daughter, and I'm treasurer of the Rainbow Families, the gay parents group here, and we all think it's probably the best place in the world for us to live. And that's to do with inclusivity, diversity, and the values of everybody that lives here, to be open-minded and have fun and enjoy their lives and respect other people.
How can we get our hands on a copy of this fabulous book?
So I've had some fantastic launches in Brighton. I want to thank Kathy from Kempdown Bookshop. She's been amazing. And just to note that she's taken over the shop in the summer. She's got this amazing room upstairs. If people want to go and write up there, they're very welcome to do so. And a whole sort of platform of different authors and poets that she's interviewing. So you can get it in Kempdown Bookshop, the Feminist Bookshop, and City Books. I believe it's now in Waterstones in Brighton, which is great. And if you want to just be a bit naughty and buy it off Amazon, it's also there.
Thank you so much for joining us, Helen. And how can we find and follow you and see what you're writing?
Well, please do follow me and see me writing around Brighton. So I'm on Instagram at Helen Trevorrow, and my website is helentrevorrow.com, and I list there any events that I'm doing. And I'll be at... The Coast is Queer is the sort of literary festival in October, and I'll be at that, I think, on a panel for speculative fiction. So would love to see people there.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Anna. Really appreciate it.
Our book club book this month is Bolu Babalola's Honey and Spice. For anyone that listens to the show will know I absolutely adored Love and Colour, which is a reworking of ancient stories, absolutely beautifully done. Unfortunately, Bolu couldn't join us on the show today because she's taking a well-earned break, so I'm joined by the second best thing, who is Katie Packer, who is Bolu's editor. For me, Honey and Spice is an exquisite romantic comedy. It's funny and touching and moving and dripping in glorious romantic tension. Babalola is the self-proclaimed rom connoisseur and has knocked it out of the park with her debut novel. Welcome to the show, Katie.
Hi, well, thanks for having me.
Do you remember the first time you read this book?
Yeah, I do. I do. It landed in my inbox after some waiting for a while for it to come in, knew it was happening. Bolu had been working on it for, I think, up 4 years, and she was writing this book before Love and Colour came to be. So I always knew she was working on a novel. And when it landed with me, I vividly remember. I obviously had worked with her and her writing for a while. But I think there was something really glorious about reading it in like a full novel. You know, the short stories were almost such like glorious little tasters of what she could do. But reading it in this full form, was just like so electric, and I knew that she could develop character, but this was just, she did it just so amazingly, but also like everything that I could have wanted from her to do. And so yeah, it was a very exciting moment for me.
And are you happy with the reaction so far, and why do you think it's resonating with so many people?
Yeah, we're so happy with it. I know Bolu is absolutely chuffed to bits, and I think, you know, romance and rom-coms are so important to her, and the fact that they can often be seen as being not as serious, you know, or as important, but actually they're such a key part to like the cultural landscape. And I think people are really like celebrating in that with the book. I think people are kind of seeing that we've had a bit of a dearth of really good, like fun pop culture-y rom-coms. You know, we had kind of had our heyday of where they were making it into films a while ago, and kind of had that, I guess we kind of get those moments when we see like To All the Boys I Loved Before and Bridgerton a bit, but this is a whole new, I guess, style of rom-com, because she is centering Black people and this at this African Caribbean society, and it's just a rom-com with a whole new flavour, a whole new difference. And I think that's just something, and she's such a unique voice, so altogether it makes this like incredible package that I think people are really loving and responding to. And of course, like Black women are being hugely supportive of the book, because it's just like something that hasn't happened for too long, and actually that they really deserve and should see themselves reflected. So that's been a really lovely reaction too.
Absolutely. The setting in Honey and Spice is kind of ambiguous. So we know it's somewhere in Sussex in the southeast, but it's never too clear. And there are some real elements of the kind of USA university landscape and system in there. Was this deliberate, do you think, to make it more universal?
Yeah, so I think there was definitely the to make it more universal is really key. And I think so Bolu's influences are quite global as well, because she's obviously British Nigerian, so there's going to be like Nigerian influence, British influence, but she's also got really strong connections with the US and goes out there a lot and has a lot of American friends. So that kind of influenced her work as well. And some of her biggest like inspirations as far as TV and books go are American. So that's why that kind of found its way in as well. But I think it's a really nice way to do it. And they do it in sex education, which I really love, and it kind of lets you get lost in it a bit more than just trying to, I guess, kind of not trying to make the location as accurate as it has to be in you know, a physical sense, but kind of getting lost in the imagination of it a bit is quite nice.
Absolutely. So talk about international. This book has just been chosen as Reese Witherspoon's Book Club book. What does this mean for a book from a publishing perspective?
Yeah, I guess the Reese's Book Club pick is, it's about elevating these titles and giving them, giving them their moment in the sun. And obviously Reese Witherspoon is just such a powerful, incredible woman in the US. And people really trust her opinion. They really trust what she says about books. And I think for the publishing side, it's just really great when one of your books is selected for this because of the kind of the awareness it builds of the book, and it gives it that extra kind of push into the world sphere and gets people excited about it.
Let's talk about Malachi. I'm in love with Malachi. and I don't think I'm alone. I know that people around the UK and beyond share my pain that he just doesn't exist, which is actually quite upsetting. This book has really resonated with readers over on TikTok, especially, who feel the same about Honey and Spice as I do, and has been chosen as TikTok's second book club read. In your experience in publishing, how have you seen TikTok change the way that people read and consume books?
That's a really good question. I think TikTok is just giving a whole new space for readers to discuss books, to come together and laugh or cry or just like talk about their favorite books. And it's kind of reaching this new generation. And it's so nice to see that it's kind of building an excitement around books in a kind of like meme type viral way. But sales-wise, it can go crazy if a book goes viral on there. And I guess that's what it is. It's giving books viral moments, which we just haven't seen before on any other platform, which is obviously incredible as far as sales and publishing go. But it's also amazing for authors and these authors who haven't necessarily had their break yet. I mean, and their books have been out, say, for like a good like 10 years, and then suddenly they go viral on TikTok and they start selling thousands of copies a week. I mean, I'd bloody love that if that
happened. It's not to be sniffed at.
No, it definitely isn't. So yeah, I think it's just a really good new way for people to be sharing what they love and what they're reading.
Absolutely. And to really, I guess, the kind of wall between the author and the audience that just was kind of up before in this kind of glorified, this is the author, we cannot touch them. That's kind of just doesn't exist now. People can speak directly to authors.
No, yeah, they're probably having conversations. And I think that's what's lovely about the kind of like Malachi hype with Bolo, is they can really literally be like to Bolo, how have you created such a hot man? And can you like
make him exist?
Do some like Frankenstein thing and bring him to life. Like, it is really funny and fun for authors to see that level of like engagement with their work, where they're literally just, you know, falling in love with the characters on that level.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell us what is next for Bolu?
What's next for Bolu? So yeah, she has another novel coming, and it's called Sun Under Skin. It's going to be her second novel, and it follows Malachi and Kiki, but, and I don't want to get this wrong, maybe 8 or 10 years on. So it's a little bit more adult. It's a bit more I guess it's now she's making the characters reach sort of her age group, so she can kind of write for that age group as well. And it's going to be very sexy. She's promised many, many sex scenes and lots of sauce and lots of just Malachi being the most incredible fictional character all of time.
it's so important to remember that he's fictional, but also the fact that someone can think him up just kind of gives me hope in the future.
Yeah, but we all want to be with men written by women. That's the problem.
Oh my gosh, that is literally it. That is the of today's interview. Katie, as a publisher, I know that you work mostly in nonfiction these days, but do you have any advice for anyone that's looking to get a book published by a bigger publisher?
Anyone who's looking to get a book? Yeah, I think something that is so key is obviously when you're a creative and you're working on your own and you're kind of like writing this kind of big piece of work, I think sometimes you're seeing it so involved, but actually you need to take almost a step back and think about your like 1-2 line pitch. Think about like the kind of commercial qualities of your book, because that is obviously, there's going to be a big part that they want to love your writing. There's no doubt about that. But a publisher is looking for how they're going to sell this book into the big retailers like Waterstones and Amazon and all the rest. And what they need for that is a really key sales pitch, and a really good way to just see how they do this is by looking on Amazon descriptions and just reading some of the biggest books, Amazon descriptions, because publishers write those. And it kind of shows you, it gives you the kind of language that you need to be able to sort of sell your book. And I think it's always good to have that idea of the commercial side of things, while also obviously enjoying creativity and letting it flow. But just that's what all big publishers are looking for, that really good selling pitch.
Thank you so much for joining us, Katie. How can we find and follow you?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter a bit too much. I'm at Katie Arpaca, and it comes up as Flaming Nora. Don't ask. And I also have a podcast called The Main Characters Podcast, so check that out.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club. Our next book club book is speculative thriller The Pharmacist by Rochelle Atala. In the end, very few people made it to the bunker. Now they wait there for the outside world to heal. Wolf is one of the lucky ones. She's safe and employed as the bunker's pharmacist, doling out medicine under the watchful eye of their increasingly erratic and paranoid leader. This is a masterclass in writing claustrophobia and the threat of violence and oppression. The book club is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. You can get in touch with us on Instagram at btnbookclub and email us at brightonbookclub@gmail.com. If you are interested in sponsoring an episode, get in touch. We are leaving you today with new music from Brighton-based producer CMD Control with Aliza Legsinay on vocals. Find them both on Spotify. See you next month.
Breathing, time to break down, no stress. We're wide awake now, young blood, the race, our mistakes now. Paying up everything we want now. See me dancing out in my street, kissing everyone that I meet. Don't think I'm gonna give it away now, cause I'm blasting at the rave now. Can't stop cause I'm going on a mission. The word is out, everyone in position. I don't care if I never see the sun. I ain't got time cause we getting shit done, ayy. It's happening, go tell your friend. It's happening. Deja vu. There's power in the people. Now it's over to you.